Well, thank you all for being here, too. I know to come up to Holden in the winter is a commitment, and to come up to spend your time listening to me share some thoughts on this is an extra commitment, and we'll see if you're still here tomorrow morning to continue with that. But I appreciate all of you being here, and I hope during our time together, we'll have a chance not just to have me talk at you, but to have us talk together. One of my guiding principles in scripture study, and I'll share a little bit more about where this comes from, is that it's meant to be done together. It's not meant to be done in private, although sometimes we need to do it that way. But the Bible was written, especially the Gospels were written, for people on the journey together to help us know where we're going and to help each other know where we're going, and to invite us to understand more about who God is and what we're called to as God's people, and to do that together. So if, starting tomorrow, you have a Bible handy, or if there are some extra ones here in the village that you might like to borrow, I encourage you to bring one if you like, and follow along in the passages we'll be looking at. In a minute, I'll say a little more about what those are, but part of my style and what I hope is helpful for you folks is to follow particular passages in great detail. And it helps if you have them in front of you, so you're not just listening to me. And also, so that we can compare translations. One of, I think, our greatest limitations in being English speakers and trying to look at the Bible is the Bible's not written in English. And sometimes we suffer under the illusion that it was by having one translation in front of us. And when we have a group, we have the great benefit of perhaps having a diversity of translations and getting to hear what others say and puzzling over why they're different, and then the conversation gets started. So just to start us off tonight, tonight is a prologue, which is a John's Gospel term for the words at the beginning of John's Gospel, which we already heard one verse of in the Vesper service. Not the part I want to focus on, but I would just invite us to get, as we get started, just to take a minute of quiet and get ourselves comfortable in whatever way we can, and be present here in the light that shines in darkness. And I'll just, once we get some quiet, I'll share a couple of verses from this gospel just to help us focus on where we're going this evening. The true light, which enlightens all people, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world came to be through him, but the world did not know him. He came into his own, but his own would not receive him. But to those who did receive him, he gave them authority to become children of God, those believing in his name, who were born not from blood, not from the will of the flesh, and not from the will of a man, but were born from God. Those verses form the center of what in John's Gospel is called the prologue. And they're our roadmap. They're the roadmap for Lent. They're the roadmap for what we'll be doing tonight and the next couple of days. Lent, as most of us probably already know, is from a word meaning springtime. It's in its root, a celebration of the triumph of life over death, of the return out of the darkness and the coldness of winter to the light of the earth and the light of growth and seeds and fertility. For the early Christian communities, it was a time of a similar kind of movement in people's lives. It was an invitation to people who were intrigued by these stories of this one who had risen from the dead to come a little closer to the community of his followers, to find out a little more about what that invitation was about, to find out a little more of what the commitment might be and what the cost of that commitment might be. For those who were already committed to being a part of that community through baptism, it was a call to think about it again, to pray about it again, to talk about it again together in the community of believers, so that it wouldn't become stale and stagnant. Because as the people of what we call the Johannine community knew, the world, a symbol which we'll explore throughout the weekend, was constantly waiting to shine darkness upon the light, to pull us out of what we're committed to and back into the way things are, rather than to continue on the path of the way things ought to be and can be. So it became an annual ritual, just as certainly an annual ritual of anybody connected with the earth, to await the softness of the soil and the cracking open of seeds and the first buds of spring, to go through that same process in our own hearts individually and together as a community, to crack open the shell that grows around our own hearts through the winter and to be open to whatever new growth that calls us to. My wife Maggie and I spent 5 years being challenged and growing through a community called Galilee Circle in Seattle. That grew out of a combination of people who had been involved in peace and justice work of one kind or another, through Pax Christi, through Central America work, through activity at the Trident base over in Bangor, Washington. And then out of the work of someone that some of you I know have heard of or may even know, named Ched Myers, who had been part of a similar community called the Bartimaeus Community in Berkeley for 9 years. And out of the Bartimaeus community's life, Ched did a lot of work around Mark's Gospel through their journey as a community through Mark's Gospel, and wrote a book out of that called Binding the Strong Man. Our little circle, Galilee Circle, started reading Ched's book after a few people had gone to a retreat that he'd given in Philadelphia. And we found our eyes open to things in the gospel that we never had expected to be there through Ched's insights and through our own exploration through about the 12 or 14 of us together on a weekly basis. During the process of looking at Mark in that detail, I got intrigued with the question of whether Ched had found something unique about Mark's gospel that was really special about Mark, or whether there was something about how Ched was reading the Bible that would apply to other parts of the Bible as well. And that's what led me to start looking at John's gospel, and what convinced those of us in Galilee Circle after we were finished with Mark to spend a couple of years reading John together, which we did, a little at a time, and that led to this little piece right here, which people look at sometimes and say 500 pages, you know, on the Gospel of John. And the funny thing is, as commentaries on John's Gospel go, it's kind of short. Believe it or not, some of the ones that preceded it are 14 to 1600 pages, which is a remarkable thing for a Gospel that's about 20 pages long. And that commentaries that were written 30 years ago are considered very old for a text that's over 1,900 years old, which I think is a wonderful thing, because what it says is that we as a Christian community are recognizing that our understanding continues to progress and change. And I like the point in Marty Haugen's introduction of the Vespers 86, that in naming it 86, so he's recognizing that same point, that you know, everything we say and do as people of faith grows out of who we are in a given time and place. And sometimes that continues to be helpful along the way, and sometimes that becomes obsolete as we see new things that make our old insights less valuable. So this book's relatively fresh. I hope it's still of some value. It just came out last fall. it's a little bit of my roadmap through John's Gospel beyond the passages we'll look at together if you find some of this interesting. One of the things that will guide what I want to share with you about John's Gospel, and I hope is valuable for your own reflection in this retreat format, is that the people in the Johannine community were faced with very real choices in whether to become Christian and whether to stay Christian or not. You know, for most of us in North America, you know, it's not that heavy a thing to choose. You know, whether we're Catholic or Protestant, whether we're Christian or Buddhist, whether we're agnostic or New Age, it's kind of just our personal choice, and people more or less think it's okay to be whatever we want to be. And all religions are more or less the same, aren't they? They're all kind of different ways to the same God. And, you know, we have a very toleristic, pluralistic world. a toleristic, that's a good word, tolerant, pluralistic world. And we're very hesitant to cast judgments upon anybody else's religion, anybody else's way of being. And I'm not suggesting we be any other way, but in the first century, people weren't that way. It was a serious thing to make a choice of a particular religious path, and as we'll look at, especially tomorrow, for the people that chose to become Christian around this gospel in the first century, it was a life or death choice. To choose to be Christian was to risk your life, to risk capital punishment at the hands of the empire. I firmly believe that if we lived out the gospel in this culture, we'd face the same consequences. It would become a life or death choice for us too, more so every day as we look at the political landscape around us. The contrast between what this gospel calls us to and the way the world is are pretty dramatic in my view, and if you disagree, please say so, but hope as the weekend goes by, at least you'll hear what John's gospel says, and you can disagree with that in your own time or amongst yourselves. So at one level, it's deadly serious. But in good biblical fashion, the antidote to deadly seriousness, or at least the way to swallow the medicine of deadly seriousness, is through uproarious humor. How many of you were ever taught that the Bible is funny? Not very many of you. The Bible is funny. If you get nothing else out of this weekend than that, the Bible is funny. We just don't get the jokes. Because they're jokes from another culture, another time. Think how hard it is to translate jokes from in a middle class United States to some other country now, or even to another part of the subculture of America, let alone across the time and place of Palestine in 1900 years. It's very funny. Part of the reason it's funny is to allow us to continue to read it in the face of what it's calling us to. Part of the reason it's funny is because humor helps us remember. You know, especially for people who are not always literate, and for whom even those who are literate, written documents were rare. One good way to remember things is to make them funny. You know, you might not remember anything else I say tonight, but if I crack a couple of good jokes, you're going to go tell those to your friends probably, or anybody else out there. Humor helps us remember. And if we can notice the places in the Bible that are funny, I think we'll remember them, and it'll help guide us through the season of Lent. So far, so good? You with me so far? Okay. The prologue in John's Gospel is unique to John. There are no other Gospels that have this extended kind of poem at the beginning. And I just want to draw attention to... I've got the pens in my pockets if the kids didn't get them. Good idea. To what it's contrasting in the beginning.
There.
He came into his own, and his own didn't receive him. You know, the first question is, who were his own? This logos, this light. Not referred to as Jesus, by the way, but we all assume that's who it's talking about. It never says Jesus in that part of the prologue. It just says the logos, the light, came into his own. Who was Jesus' own that wouldn't receive him? Louder? Anybody? I heard somebody say something.
I said the Jews.
The Jews. Okay. Thought that's what you might say. And what I want to suggest at the beginning here is that John's Gospel, although most of our Bibles translate Jesus' opponents as the Jews, is not talking about the Jews as the opponents. John's Gospel is the single biggest source of Christian anti-Semitism in our 2,000-year history, because it appears, because of our translations, that it's anti-Jewish. If your Bible says Jews, every time the Greek says Judaioi, then you can't help but walk away from reading John's Gospel and from Lent, believing that the Christians were a group of people opposed by Jews, not just by Jewish leaders, but opposed by Jews. There was this big break, Christians were persecuted by Jews, and therefore it's not surprising that Christians persecuted Jews thereafter. And therefore, there's this great horrible split and ultimately the Holocaust. Well, tonight, at least as an introduction, and I hope we'll see throughout the weekend, that misunderstands the thrust of what John's gospel is about and ultimately what the challenge of Lent is about for us. I'm going to suggest in here that Judaioi should be translated Judeans. Because what John's gospel is contrasting when it refers to his own who wouldn't receive him with to those who did receive him who were given authority to become children of God it's not an ethnic struggle here. It's not even a religious struggle. I'm going to suggest here it's a political and economic struggle that's at issue. And ultimately that becomes a theological struggle. It's a question of where does God live? Who controls access to God? What does it mean to be committed to God alone in the face of all the other commitments that challenge us for allegiance? In Palestine in the first century, most of us probably know, there was Galilee in the north, and then Samaria here in the center, and Judea down here in the south, and Jordan River down here. And down here in Judea is the capital, Jerusalem, the Omphalos, Greek, the navel, the center of the universe. From the biblical perspective. You know, all the prophets say in the end, all will come to Zion, all will come to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the headquarters. It's where, for centuries, everyone believed all peoples would flow. People that live in this area are called Judeans. And then up here, of course, are Galileans, in the middle are Samaritans. Ultimately, for John's gospel, Judeans refers not simply to those people who live in Judea, as opposed to those people who live in Galilee, or Greeks and others who live everywhere else. That's the only other geographic designation, people, or ethnic designation. But those who identify and support the Jerusalem point of view on the world. An example from our culture. I live in Seattle. As most of you know, Seattle has a couple big employers these days, Microsoft and Boeing. A few years back, when the Cold War was more hot than it is now, Boeing was a major defense contractor. Still a major defense contractor, but not as big as it once was. Whatever your views about militarism, whatever your views about cruise missiles and B-2 bombers and all the other things that Boeing made, if you lived in Seattle, you liked Boeing getting defense contracts because it supports everything. The churches in Seattle are totally reliant on Boeing providing money. And if Boeing gets the money from the Defense Department and spends it on B-2 bombers and that pays employees, and employees shop at the stores and employees tie to the churches and Boeing gives to the churches and Boeing pays taxes to the schools, et cetera, then you want Boeing to get defense contracts, even if you don't like war. If you live in Washington, D.C., as I once did, doesn't matter what your politics are, you sure like the government being in Washington, D.C., because that's the primary employer. That's what keeps Washington, D.C. going economically. So you like a strong centralized federal government, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Independent. If you live in Washington, D.C., you want there to be a lot of federal spending and a big government, because that means more people that live there and more people that support your business, etc. Well, Jerusalem was primarily the economic center of Palestine. Regardless of what you thought about the temple, regardless of what you thought about who God was and is, regardless of how you lived your life, it sure is nice if you live in Jerusalem that the religious capital of all of Palestine and of the whole diaspora of Jews throughout the Mediterranean is where you happen to live. Because 3 times a year, every good Jew is supposed to come there and spend a lot of money. And that helps you. Helps you live in a culture, especially in a culture of scarcity, where you rely on that. Just like our merchants rely on Christmas, no matter what they believe about Jesus or anything else. You know, December is shopping season. You know, if people don't Christmas shop, we're out of business. No matter what you think about Jesus or God or anything. Okay? In John's Gospel, those who did not receive him are Judeans. Those who throughout the Gospel are painted as identifying with the way things are, rather than being open to a possibility of things being different, other than they might be. Some scholars have tried to talk around their discomfort about the anti-Judaism by saying it's referring to the Jewish leaders. And it's only referring to the Jewish leaders in the first century. So since there are nobody's around from the first century, and that whole structure of Judaism is gone anyway, therefore, it's not talking about anybody now, which they think washes their hands of the issue of anti-Semitism. And it does. It throws the baby out with the bathwater, too. Because I want to suggest that the challenge of Lent for us is whether or not we are Judeans or whether we are Galileans. Galileans has nothing to do with whether you live in Galilee, as seen throughout the Gospel as well. Galileans are those outside of the status quo, who don't benefit from the way things are, who have to travel a long distance to do all the things that they're expected to do by the elite and by the religious leaders, and everything they've been told is how God wants things to be. They're the people exposed to all kinds of influences who aren't sure what to do. Literally in their time were exposed to Greek culture and Gnostic religion and Judaism and early Christianity and all kinds of other things that competed for their hearts and minds and could easily be confusing. And what are we supposed to do? We're not sure. We're not nearly as clear as these people are down here who seem to know exactly who God is and where God lives and what it means to be God's people. We're not sure. You know, you see it so much on Good Friday when there's Peter in the courtyard and they recognize him by his accent. You know, you're a hick. You're from the South, in this case from the North. You know, you're a country bumpkin. You're not sophisticated like the rest of us. You don't know anything. That's all implied in Peter's being recognized by his accent. So the challenge for us here is whether we are Judeans, people who are pretty clear on where God lives and what it means to be God's people, you know, the way it is the way it's supposed to be, or whether we're Galileans, people who aren't sure, who may be confused, who are constantly on the move, who are exposed to all kinds of influences, who aren't benefiting necessarily from the way things are, or at least see a lot of people who aren't benefiting from them and think that that's not right too, even if we personally might benefit. This other piece of the equation here, those who did receive, were given authority to become children of God. Now that might play a little bit with our sense that aren't we all children of God by just being earth creatures? Aren't we children of God, if nothing else, then by baptism? If not simply by the fact of our being born on this planet of creatures of our Creator? Well, according to John's Gospel, and I'm going to suggest also according to Lent, children of God is something we have authority to become. Not to be, once and for all, but to become. An ongoing process of becoming. And it's a very powerful invitation. Because to the extent that we think of Jesus as Son of God, this Gospel is inviting us to become sons and daughters of God. I'll suggest that this Gospel is inviting us to the same relationship with God that Jesus had. No more, no less. John's Gospel holds Jesus up as one who always knew who God was and always did what he saw God doing. You know, a pretty clear communication, pretty centered person, knowing what he was about, able to resist all the forces of darkness and evil around him. And sometimes we want to put that Jesus on a pedestal and raise him up and worship him and honor him and think, isn't that wonderful? And I'm going to suggest this Gospel is saying, Jesus isn't on a pedestal. Jesus has left so that we can grow. We won't get to the passages in the Last Supper discourse where Jesus says of them, unless I leave, you cannot receive the Spirit. And it's that very Spirit that this community and the gospel and us as their descendants are invited to find in our midst. So it says, you know, after the resurrection in chapter 20, when they're behind, they've already experienced Jesus risen in their midst, and 8 days later, they're still behind locked doors for fear of the Judeans. I mean, imagine, right? There they are. They've found a risen Jesus in their midst, and they're still hiding. And Jesus says, get out of here. Go, you know. Take this Spirit I'm giving you and go, because the world needs you out there, not hidden in here. But it's that very Spirit that they find in their midst that we're invited during Lent to find in our midst, in the midst of our own hearts, in our families, in our communities from wherever we come from, our community here this weekend, that calls us to that same relationship with God that Jesus had. And it calls us to that with three negatives and a positive. And that's what I want to explore more over the weekend together. But just to set those out here. To those who believed in his name, and to believe in his name is not a magic trick. We lose that from our culture. Somebody's name is their being in the ancient world. To know someone's name, to say their name, is to invoke all of who they are. You know, when Moses encounters God at the burning bush, and God says, you know, I send you out to lead my people from bondage to freedom. And Moses says, who shall I say sent me? And God utters that unpronounceable, untranslatable word that we sometimes, you know, botch into a four-letter word and say Yahweh, as if God's name was Yahweh. But it was, you know, God's response of, my name is beyond your control. You cannot know my name, because if you know my name, then you control me in some way. And yet, for Christians, for the New Testament, for John's Gospel during Lent, the invitation is to believe in this name of Jesus, not as a magic trick, not as if we had pronounced the name Jesus and things will happen. We all know that doesn't quite work that simply. But to believe in all of what Jesus was saying, all of who he was, all of what he was calling us to do and be, which is laid out for us in this gospel and, of course, in the rest of our tradition as well. To believe in that name and to be born not of blood, which we'll talk about, not of the will of flesh, which is tomorrow morning's Nicodemus session, and not of the will of a man, which, amusingly to my mind, and we'll talk about this with the Samaritan woman passage, we'll talk about this piece also tomorrow, but just to point out now, for those of you who think, why is he using this gender-exclusive language? I thought this was Holden Village and we're supposed to be inclusive around here. This place in the prologue is one of only three places in John's Gospel where the Greek word for a male person is used, as opposed to anthropos, which anthropology, you know, human beings. And it's specifically a man for a reason. So Bibles like the New Revised Standard, which attempt to be inclusive there like that, miss the point. It's specifically an issue about being born of a man, which isn't, of course, the will of a man, which isn't normally how we think if we're born, is it? Since we're usually born out of women's bodies. So what does it mean to be born of the will of a man anyway? You can think about that till tomorrow morning, if you like. But those are the three knots. Not to be born of blood, and just to intrigue you a little bit, in the Greek it's plural, whatever that refers to. Not to be born of bloods, not to be born of the will of flesh, and not to be born of the will of a man, but to be born of God. Born of God, to be become children of God. Not something that applies uniquely to Jesus, but that we're all invited to do. That's our roadmap. And before we go any farther, I just want to hear any questions, comments, things you'd like to share. You know, as you'll see, I have a tendency to go on and on here, so I'd really like to open this up and let some of our time together at least be shared time. We got some here. Thoughts so far? This is just all so familiar. We've heard it all before. That nothing to. Why is he boring us with all this old stuff here? Yeah. If I could ask too, if you speak as loud as you can, because I know that if people are going to listen to tape, it'd be helpful to hear the questions or comments.
I am curious. Why is it that you chose those to be
edited? Good question. I should have said that early on. The reason I chose it after reading Mark's gospel with Ched's help was that I wanted to pick the gospel that was least like Mark, to see whether it was something about Mark, which of course most of Mark is in Matthew and Luke also, or whether it's something about the method. And I hope, as you'll see, it's something about the method. It's not about Mark, although Mark's gospel has some wonderful things that aren't in John because they are so different. You know, the synoptics are much more concerned with economics directly, you know, issues of rich and poor, and all the wonderful parables about wealth and poverty and things of the earth and such. And John's gospel doesn't talk much directly about economics. Its economic points are more inferred from the context, like this issue about Judeans and Galileans. But that was the reason, to see how different it was. And remember Ched saying to me at the time, good luck, because I've never understood what John's gospel is about, so I look forward to seeing what you come up with. And he was gracious enough to write the prologue to this, so you can see what he had to say about that in the first couple of pages. Good question. It's worth saying something about method here, too, because that's ultimately the tool that I hope you can bring back. You know, retreat is not a class, so I'm hoping this is what leads to reflection and, you know, Lent and all that, and this isn't about so much intellectual content as it is, you know, what's going on in our hearts and, you know, where are we being called during the season of the year and the season of our lives. But a couple of points about reading, that if you're inclined to reflect on these passages during your quiet time or any other time during Lent, that might be worth pointing out. One has to do with a great cultural difference between the ancient people and us. For us, words are cheap. You know, I can crank out 200,000 words here in this thing, and you can pick it up for $20, and $20 may sound like a lot of money, but divide that by that many words, and it's kind of cheap. You know? 100 words for a penny. That's better than 2 sparrows for a penny, huh? In the ancient world, words were precious. Not just economically precious. Not just precious because so few people were literate and there wasn't much papyrus or leather or other things to write upon, but precious because people respected the power of words that we don't. You know, our newspapers have thousands of words and we skim them, we throw them away and recycle them. And we read books, whole novels, and people say, gee, was it good? Yeah, I really liked it. What was it about? Well, it's about these people, and they had this relationship, and we say it in 25 or 50 words, and that's all we remember, because we probably read it 50 or 60 pages an hour. We read it once, we'll probably never read it again, because there are other books to read, other newspapers and magazines. We're a throwaway culture. Words pass through. We skim, for the most part. For the biblical times, over the whole course of biblical time, words were precious. You know, whether it's Genesis or John, God's power is in the Word. You know, in Genesis 1, God speaks and things happen. You know, that's the primal activity of creation, is through the power of words being cast out there into the void. In John's Gospel, we have it in the first verses, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Now, literally, the Logos is more than what we think of as Word, the Greek word that we translate Word, Logos. But still, it points out the power of words in the ancient world. No words were wasted. We so often read and pay no attention to the nuance and the detail. We're not very poetic. You know, we might like poetry once in a while, but we've never studied it, at least not since college, for most of us. We don't, how many of us have read books of poetry in the last few years? You know, not very many. What percent? For those who do, what percentage of the words you read, do you pay attention to the nuances of sentence structure and grammar? Not from an intellectual standpoint, you know, not from a linguistic standpoint, but from being with the words, just spending time with them, letting them bounce around with us, letting them resonate through us. The ancient people had respect for the power of words. Every word in the Bible is there for a reason. Every word is important. As we'll look at tomorrow with the Nicodemus passage, a the or an a, missing or present, can change the whole meaning of a passage. Our translators, for reasons that baffle me, often miss those subtleties, as we'll see at the beginning of the Nicodemus passage. So that's one thing. Every word counts. And I can't emphasize that enough because it's so contrary to our way of reading. To read slowly, to let the words just be with us, whether it's in a prayerful way or just a quiet, reflective way, every word is important. Second, we're used to hearing Scripture proclaimed on Sunday, out of context. You know, there's that wonderful passage from Corinthians we just heard tonight, but where did that fit into Paul's letter to the Corinthians? Where did that fit into the struggles of the people of Corinth? Why did Paul write that letter? And what was that passage doing in the context of his overall claim that he was making to the people of Corinth at that time? Well, how many of us know? We hear those words read as if they were written in English now, to us now, but they weren't. Hopefully they speak to us now in our world, and if they don't, then I think we should leave them behind, just like Marty Haugen's Vesper Service or my book or anything else. If they don't speak to us, then we should find some other words that speak to us, other stories that do. They speak to me. I hope they speak to you, or probably wouldn't be here. But they were written in their own time and place. And to know what they say to us now, we've got to know something about what they said in their original context. Tomorrow we'll look at the passage about Jesus saying to Nicodemus, unless you are born again, or born from above, play on words in Greek, you cannot see the reign of God. Well, we have a whole context of born-again Christians. Well, I assure you, that's not what's going on in the Nicodemus passage of what most of us associate with the term born-again Christians. Because that term born again is taken completely out of its first century context and out of its context in the course of John's gospel. So there's two issues there. One is the cultural one, the social one. If John's gospel is there, and we're looking at a given passage, there's everything about first century Palestine that is part of that. And, you know, not to overburden you and to make it too fearsome a challenge, but there's also all of Hebrew scripture back here behind it. You know, one of the overwhelming things about John's gospel throughout, and all the gospels, is how little they have to say that's new, really. How 90% of what they say was already said. Most Christians don't know Hebrew scripture very well, so it sounds new to us. But if we read Hebrew scripture, we'd recognize Isaiah already said that. Moses already said that. Jeremiah already said that. It's all been said over and over again in the past. And it's being added on in little subtle ways here in the New Testament. But it's building on a long tradition that came up to this point. You know, down here is us as readers. And then there's this horrible gap between us here. And what I'd suggest the challenge of Lent is, and really any time we're reading the Bible, but especially of Lent, is to reflect not only on first century Palestine and what made up John's gospel, but on 20th century North America and what makes up us. Because often, this is as secret to us as this is. Who are we, and how did we get to be who we are? As whatever people of ethnic background we are, whatever religion we are, whatever part of the country we live in, our own families of origin, our own professions, our own dysfunctions or other whatever psychological terms from a modern way we want to talk about those things, the things the ancient people would have talked about of demons and evil spirits that we talk about in, you know, more psychological language because we don't believe in evil spirits anymore, for the most part. You know, the call of Lent is to discover what's going on around this seemingly known quantity called us, which we don't know very well, partly by through the lens of these people in the past, who we don't know very well either. And if that sense of not knowing seems kind of discouraging or frightening, our last session on Sunday is going to deal precisely with that point, because I think the foot washing passage is exactly about revealing that the disciples, at that crucial moment on the eve of Good Friday, didn't understand anything about Jesus, about God, about themselves, about their mission, about what they were supposed to be doing with their lives. They didn't understand anything. And those are the people that Jesus says, "I call you no longer servants, but friends. Love one another as I have loved you." We'll get to that at the end. But if we find ourselves confused and not knowing, rest assured that we're exactly the same position as the disciples were in the story. And maybe it's not as quite a late date in our story as it was for them when they found themselves on the eve of Good Friday. So the more we can know about the first century world, the more we can know about how people read, how people acted, how men and women interrelated, how people traveled, you know, all the details of that culture, the more we'll understand about the gospel. And the more we read it in its context as a story. One of Ched's wonderful insights that I try to follow here is that contrary to even some of the most progressive biblical theologians like the liberation theologians or others, liberation theologians oddly use the Bible much like conservatives and fundamentalists do. And openly so, perhaps more openly than some of the fundamentalists do, which is to say that they say the parts of the Bible that support what we're about we'll use, and the parts that we find not supportive we're not going to pay any attention to. You know, writers like John Sobrino and some of the other liberation theologians said so expressly. You know, their commitment is to the liberation of people, and the passages in the Bible that don't support the liberation of people aren't of help. One of Ched's challenges, and it was a challenge to me and I invite it to be a challenge to you, is to read the Gospels all the way through and to find the consistency and coherence of the message of an entire Gospel without letting go parts of it that we find difficult. At least until we've gone all the way through it once. If when we've gotten all the way through it once and we think, you know, now that we've done that, I still don't like what he had to say at the tabernacles scene or some other place, well, fine. But at least we'll have read it in its complete context and struggled with the passages that we find difficult. Because often the ones that we find difficult and wanted to say, "I don't want to deal with that," are the ones that offer the most promise of giving us a new insight. Precisely because they make us grapple with something in ourselves that we're uncomfortable with. Something that makes us angry or frustrated or confused or sad. You know, those are the places where God speaks, not where so much where we're comfortable and happy and secure. Not when we're Judeans, when we're Galileans. So those are the keys to the method, and that's why over the course of the weekend here, I'd like to walk us through this series of passages which necessarily skip the pieces of John's Gospel that come in between, but do follow in sequence throughout the course of the Gospel themselves. Nicodemus in chapter 3, Samaritan woman in chapter 4, the man born blind in chapter 9, Lazarus in chapter 11, and the foot washing in chapter 13. If you're at all inclined, and the weather's not too nice to be outside, or those of you who work here aren't working too hard, and you're inclined to look at the passages in between the ones that we're going to look at together, you might find that it adds some insight to what we do together. But it's that call to start with the prologue, as we're doing tonight. See what it's setting out as the roadmap, the overture, the musical metaphor, and walking us through all the way to Good Friday and to Easter. Okay. Other questions, comments as we go along? Anything about the prologue itself or what we've... Judeans, I mean, is that all? You've all heard that one before, so that's not a new thing, you know? Any comments about that one? Just all makes such good sense that nothing to say. too late in the day and people are ready to go to bed? Folks? Yeah. Other people find that a puzzling invitation there at the center of the prologue?
Mm-hmm.
It is. And the nature of that authority is at the heart of what I think Lent is about. What about Lent for folks? I mean, what expectations do you have coming into Lent? What has Lent been about for you? What would you like out of this? This is my expectation, my roadmap. What would you like out of this? Anything that I haven't said so far that you're hoping for over this weekend that you want to make sure either gets covered or made time for? Just briefly for the moment, Crossan and those folks' project, for those of you who are familiar with the so-called Historical Jesus Project, is the precise flip side of what I'm trying to do here, which interestingly comes to the almost the same theological conclusions. You know, for those of you not familiar with Cross and what he's about, it's the most recent attempt to try and say, what did Jesus really say? What in the Gospels is added on by the later church and later reflection, and what did he really say? What was Jesus really like? What was he really calling people to before it got translated into these different gospels that put their own filter on it? And so his premise is precisely the opposite of mine in that he's not trying to read this as narrative at all. He's trying to extract out particular sentences, sometimes parts of sentences, that are common to several sources, both from the canonical Gospels and others, Gospel of Thomas and other ancient Gospels that didn't make it into the Bible, to try and find some kind of reliable basis for saying, this is what we think Jesus really said, and these are things added. Now, he'd be the first to acknowledge that it's an intellectual exercise that he's doing. It's not pointing at the truth of what Jesus said. In the end, the picture of Jesus of Nazareth that comes out of Crossan's work is a picture by a 20th century North American scholar. And he'd be the first to acknowledge that, and has acknowledged it in print and other places. But its method is exactly the opposite. What's interesting is that the call of the gospel that Crossan puts together, I would say, is precisely the same. Which just shows what powerful documents the Gospels are. Whether you take them apart in little pieces and look at them under a microscope, or whether you stand back a ways and look at them like something projected on a movie screen, they say the same thing. What doesn't work is when we look at them as if they were written last week in English, you know, in the Northwest or somewhere, and then we get a distorted picture of it. Because Crossan's work and what I'm trying to do here both start with the premise that it was written in its own time and place. It's just the difference of whether you read it in the sense of windows or mirrors. Is the gospel text something we look through, like a window, to get back to the Jesus who's somewhere on the other side of the window? Or are the gospels mirrors that we look at and they reflect back to us something about ourselves? And the closer we get to looking at them, the more we see that what we're seeing is us. We're not seeing Jesus, because Jesus is gone. What we're seeing is us. And that's precisely, I would suggest, what the Gospels want us to see. By looking at these stories about Jesus, they want us to see ourselves. Because Jesus is long gone. You know, in Mark's Gospel, at the end, there's just an empty tomb. There's no risen Jesus at all. Why are you standing among the dead looking for the living one? The angel says to the women, go back to Galilee. Back to Galilee. And start the journey again. Don't look for the risen one amongst the dead. So I just want to emphasize my angle on that is to not ask the questions of, did this really happen? I don't think this gospel cares about the question of, did these things really happen? Except for one point where it expressly seems to care, and even then I think it doesn't mean what we think it means usually, which is after Jesus has been killed but is still on the cross and he's stabbed by the sword, and there's all this stuff about the one who said this is witness is true and we know his witness is true and you know, it resonates with our modern sense of eyewitness testimony. I don't think it's about the historical Jesus as much as it is about the one who is risen and is found in our midst, just as much in our midst now as in the midst of that locked, behind those locked doors 1900 years ago. Yeah, as we go through each passage, I think it'll become clear what the issues were and why these particular passages were chosen by the early church as the Lenten gates to walk through. The Nicodemus story is not really one of the gates, but the Nicodemus story and the Samaritan woman story are so intertwined that since we have the luxury of six sessions, when I do four sessions for Lent, I don't have the luxury of doing Nicodemus. But an interesting piece on that is that when Galilee Circle finished our 2 years reading John's Gospel, we had a little costume party where we each came as a character from John's Gospel and didn't tell anybody who we were dressed as. And we got to figure it out through the course of the party. And there were 12 of us, and 6 of us came as Nicodemus. Because as I think we'll see, it's very easy for us to relate to Nicodemus. And as we go through each passage, I'll try and point out something about what this was like for the Johannine community, but ultimately what this means for us now in our journey through Lent in our time, which in a lot of ways is not as different from theirs as it might seem.
Where did you get that term? Would you say gateway to Lent or something?
Gates that you walk through.
Is that what is that?
That's just one of my terms, but it's an adaptation from John 10 in the Good Shepherd Discourse. You know, I am the gate, I am the door. John's Gospel is filled with these wonderful I am statements. You know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the light of the world. We'll look at some of those. Those are the Johannine equivalents of parables, the reign of God parables that we see in the Synoptic Gospels. There are no parables as such in John's Gospel. There are just these I am statements. And it's the Christian community's way of translating the answer Moses got at the burning bush into statements about Jesus. You know, the words I am in English are translations of the Greek ego eimi. Which are the Greek translations of the Hebrew Yahweh. So when in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures that was the basic version of the Bible that Jews at the time of Jesus had, since most of them didn't speak Hebrew any more than most Catholics in the 20th century didn't speak Latin. Everyone spoke Greek, though. So they had the Septuagint, their version of the Hebrew Scriptures. When Moses at the burning bush, God's response is, Ego eimi, which is the closest that they could come in translation to what Yahweh means, I am. My name is I am. Well, it becomes a wonderful literary tool in John's Gospel for all these statements about Jesus. I am the light of the world, the resurrection, the life, the way, the truth, and the life, the good shepherd. And each of those are invitations to understand something about what that presence of God in Jesus was about. I use the term gates because my sense of what it was about to become a Christian in the early church and what I would like to see it be about again, but it's an uphill battle sometimes, is that each time we take one of these steps closer to understanding what the commitment's about, we go through a door that closes behind us. And each step is a step closer. And at the center of it is community and life and light and love and all the things that this gospel promises. And left behind is darkness and fear and all the things that this gospel is trying to separate us from. But they are gates. They're one-way gates. And it's scary to go through a one-way gate. In the early church, the process of joining was called the catechumenate, still called that in some denominations these days, was a 3-year process. From the time you were interested in the possibility becoming part of the community, it took 3 years of study and reflection, both ways. It wasn't just a matter of, I want to join, so if I want to join, I can be a Christian. Like my little kid Peter says, I can do anything I want. You know, you can't tell me what to do. You know, we think that becoming anything we want to do is part of our God-given right. And in the early church, it was a relationship. You want to become a Christian? Well, let us decide whether we want you to be a Christian too. It wasn't like trying to get into law school. It wasn't an admission standard. It was a question of trust and relationship. Because, as we'll ultimately see Sunday night and beyond, betrayal comes from within. Betrayal does not come from outside. Betrayal comes from the one in our midst that we don't know who's not with us. We thought was with us, but isn't with us. In the first letter of John, we see that laid out in stark detail. There were those who were with us, and they went out from us. I guess they were never with us, because if they were really with us, they wouldn't have left and betrayed us. That's a stark Johannine language, a kind of either-or, children of God and children of the devil language in 1 John. But it really was an either-or choice in ways that it's very hard in our culture for us to get. Well, if we're Lutherans this week and we don't like it, we can be Presbyterians, and or we can be Christian Buddhists, you know, New Agey Native American types, you know. Why not? Who says we can't? Right? And in the early church, it just wasn't that way, because you had to know who you could trust. You had to know if anybody was a betrayer. If you're not really with us, you better not come in here, because our lives depend on being able to trust you. Well, how many of us think we're putting our lives in the hands of those people that we're in faith community with? Literally, putting our lives in their hands. We might spend some time getting to know each other a little better if we really thought that we were entrusting each other with our lives. And that's also what I think Lent is about. Walking that journey to the face of death, into the teeth of death, and being willing to trust that we'll come out the other side still alive. Yeah, we'll get into that right away with Nicodemus tomorrow morning, because Nicodemus's question in response to Jesus' invitation is, how is it possible? Nicodemus does not understand how it's possible. I think most of us don't understand how it's possible, too. I know I don't understand how it's possible most of the time. So that's what we'll look at first thing tomorrow morning.